what she could do. So she did. She did exactly that. And my evaluation was right. With his fingertip, he traced the symbols of danger at the bottom of the sheet. My own wife, he said.
I'm not your wife, Pat said. I changed that, too. Do you want it back the way it was? With no changes, not even in details? That won't show your inertials much. On the other hand, they're unaware anyhow, unless some of them have retained a vestigial memory, as Joe has. By now, though, it should have phased out.
Runciter said bitingly, I'd like the Mick contract back. That much, at least.
When I scout him,
G.G. Ashwood said.
I scout him.
He had become gray.
Yes, you really bring in the talent,
Runciter said. The intercom buzzed, and the quaking, elderly voice of Mrs. Frick rasped,
A group of our inertials are waiting to see you, Mr. Runciter. They say you sent for them in connection with a new joint work project. Are you free to see them?
Send them in,
Runciter said. Pat said,
I'll keep this ring.
She displayed the silver and jade wedding ring, which, in another time track, she and Joe had picked out. This much of the alternate world she had elected to retain. He wondered what, if any, legal basis she had kept in addition. None, he hoped. Wisely, however, he said nothing. Better not even to ask. The office door opened, and in pairs, the inertials entered. They stood uncertainly for a moment, and then began seating themselves facing Runciter's desk. Runciter eyed them, then pawed among the rat's nest of documents on his desk. Obviously, he was trying to determine whether Pat had changed in any way the composition of the group.
Edie Dorn, Runciter said. Yes, you're here.
He glanced at her, then at the man beside her.
Hammond. Okay, Hammond. Tippy Jackson?
He peered inquiringly.
I made it as quick as I could, Mrs. Jackson said. You didn't give me much time, Mr. Runciter.
John Ild,
Runciter said. The adolescent boy with the tousled woolly hair grunted in response. His arrogance, Joe noted, seemed to have receded. The boy now seemed introverted and even a little shaken. It would be interesting, Joe thought, to find out what he remembers, what all of them, individually and collectively, remember.
Francesca Spanish?
Runciter said. The luminous, gypsy-like dark woman, radiating a peculiar jangled tautness, spoke up.
During the last few minutes, Mr. Runciter, while we waited in your outer office, mysterious voices appeared to me and told me things.
You're Francesca Spanish?
Runciter asked her, patiently. He looked more than usually tired.
I am. I have always been. I will always be.
Miss Spanish's voice rang with conviction.
May I tell you what the voices revealed to me?
Possibly later,
Runciter said, passing on to the next personnel document.
It must be said,
Miss Spanish declared vibrantly.
All right, Runciter said. We'll take a break for a couple of minutes.
He opened a drawer of his desk, got out one of his amphetamine tablets, took it without water.
Let's hear what the voices revealed to you, Miss Spanish.
He glanced toward Joe, shrugging.
Someone,
Miss Spanish said,
just now moved us, all of us, into another world. We inhabited it, lived in it, as citizens of it, and then a vast, all-encompassing spiritual agency restored us to this, a rightful universe.
That would be Pat, Joe Chip said, Pat Conley, who just joined the firm today.
Tito Apostos,
Runciter said.
You're here?
He craned his neck, peering about the room at the seated people. A bald-headed man, wagging a goatish beard, pointed to himself. He wore old-fashioned, hip-hugging, gold lamé trousers, yet somehow created a stylish effect. Perhaps the egg-sized buttons of his kelp-green midi blouse helped. In any case, he exuded a grand dignity, a loftiness surpassing the average. Joe felt impressed.
Don Denny,
Runciter said.
Right here, sir.
A confident baritone like that of a Siamese cat declared. It arose from within a slender, earnest-looking individual who sat bolt upright in his chair, his hands on his knees. He wore a polyester dirndl, his long hair in a snood, cowboy chaps with simulated silver stars, and sandals.
You're an anti-animator,
Runciter said, reading the appropriate sheet.
The only one we use.
To Joe, he said,
I wonder if we'll need him. Maybe we should substitute another anti-telepath. The more of those, the better.
Joe said, We have to cover everything, since we don't know what we're getting into.
I guess so.
Runciter nodded.
Okay, Sammy Mundo.
A weak-nosed young man, dressed in a maxi skirt, with an undersized, melon-like head, stuck his hand up in a spasmodic, wobbling, tick-like gesture, as if, Joe thought, the anemic body had done it by itself. He knew this particular person. Mundo looked years younger than his chronological age. Both mental and physical growth processes had ceased for him long ago. Technically, Mundo had the intelligence of a raccoon. He could walk, eat, bathe himself, even, after a fashion, talk. His anti-telepathic ability, however, was considerable. Once, alone, he had blanked out S. Dole Melipone. The firm's house magazine had rambled on about it for months afterward.
Oh, yes, Runciter said. Now we come to Wendy Wright.
As always, when the opportunity arose, Joe took a long, astute look at the girl whom, if he could have managed it, he would have had as his mistress, or, even better, his wife. It did not seem possible that Wendy Wright had been born out of blood and internal organs like other people. In proximity to her, he felt himself to be a squat, oily, sweating, uneducated nerd whose stomach rattled and whose breath wheezed. Near her, he became aware of the physical mechanisms which kept him alive. Within him, machinery, pipes and valves, and gas compressors and fan belts had to chug away at a losing task, a labor ultimately doomed. Seeing her face, he discovered that his own consisted of a garish mask. Noticing her body made him feel like a low-class wind-up toy. All her colors possessed a subtle quality, indirectly lit. Her eyes, those green and tumbled stones, looked impassively at everything. He had never seen fear in them, or aversion, or contempt. What she saw, she accepted. Generally, she seemed calm. But more than that, she struck him as being durable, untroubled and cool, not subject to wear or to fatigue, or to physical illness and decline. Probably she was 25 or 26, but he could not imagine her looking younger, and certainly she would never look older. She had too much control over herself and outside reality for that.
I'm here,
Wendy said with soft tranquility. Runciter nodded.
Okay, that leaves Fred Zafsky.
He fixed his gaze on a flabby, big-footed, middle-aged, unnatural-looking individual with pasted-down hair, muddy skin, plus a peculiar protruding Adam's apple, clad for this occasion in a shift dress the color of a baboon's ass.
That must be you.
Right you are,
Zafsky agreed and sniggered.
How about that?
Christ,
Runciter said, shaking his head.
Well, we have to include one anti-parakineticist to be safe, and you're it.
He tossed down his documents and looked about for his green cigar. To Joe, he said,
That's the group, plus you and me. Any last-minute changes you want to make?
I'm satisfied, Joe said.
You suppose this bunch of inertials is the best combination we can come up with?
Runciter eyed him intently.
Yes, Joe said.
And it's good enough to take on Hollis's size?
Yes, Joe said.
But he knew otherwise. It was not something he could put his finger on. It certainly was not rational. Potentially, the counter-field capacity of the 11 inertials had to be considered enormous. And yet,
Mr. Chip, can I have a second of your time?
Mr. Apostos, bald-headed and bearded, his gold LeMay trousers glittering, plucked at Joe Chip's arm.
Could I discuss an experience I had late last night? In a hypnagogic state, I seem to have contacted one or possibly two of Mr. Hollis's people, a telepath evidently operating in conjunction with one of their precogs. Do you think I should tell Mr. Runciter? Is it important?
Hesitating, Joe Chip looked toward Runciter, seated in his worthy, beloved chair, trying to relight his all-Havana cigar. Runciter appeared terribly tired. The wattles of his face sagged.
No, Joe said. Let it go.
Ladies and gentlemen,
Runciter said, raising his voice above the general noise.
We're leaving now for Luna. You 11 inertials, Joe Chip and myself and our client's rep, Zoe Wirt. 14 of us in all. We'll use our own ship.
He got out his round, gold, anachronistic pocket watch and studied it.
3:30. Pratfall 2 will take off from the main roof field at 4.
He snapped his watch shut and returned it to the pocket of his silk sash.
Well, Joe,
he said,
we're in this for better or worse. I wish we had a resident precog who could take a look ahead for us.
Both his face and the tone of his voice drooped with worry. And the cares, the irreversible burden of responsibility and age. 6.
We wanted to give you a shave like no other you ever had. We said, it's about time a man's face got a little loving. We said, with Ubik's self-winding Swiss chromium never-ending blade, the days of scrape-scrape are over. So try Ubik, and be loved.
Warning. Use only as directed, and with caution.
Welcome to Luna,
Zoe Wirt said cheerfully, her jolly eyes enlarged by her red-framed triangular glasses.
Via myself, Mr. Howard says hello to each and every one of you, and most especially to Mr. Glenn Runciter for making his organization, and you people in particular, available to us. This subsurface hotel suite, decorated by Mr. Howard's artistically talented sister Leda, lies just 300 linear yards from the industrial and research facilities which Mr. Howard believes to have been infiltrated. Your joint presence in this room, therefore, should already be inhibiting the psionic capabilities of Hollis's agents, a thought pleasing to all of us.
She paused, looked over them all.
Are there any questions?
Tinkering with his test gear, Joe Chip ignored her. Despite their client's stipulation, he intended to measure the surrounding psionic field. During the hour-long trip from Earth, he and Glenn Runciter had decided on this.
I have a question,
Fred Zafsky said, raising his hand. He giggled.
Where's the bathroom?
You will each be given a miniature map,
Zoe Wirt said,
on which this is indicated.
She nodded to a drab female assistant, who began passing out brightly colored glossy paper maps.
This suite,
she continued,
is complete with a kitchen, all the appliances of which are free, rather than coin-operated. Obviously, outright blatant expense has been incurred in the constructing of this living unit, which is ample enough for 20 persons, possessing, as it does, its own self-regulating air, heat, water, and unusually varied food supply, plus closed-circuit TV and high-fidelity polyphonic phonograph sound system. The two latter facilities, however, unlike the kitchen, being coin-operated. To aid you in utilizing these recreation facilities, a change-making machine has been placed in the game room.
My map, Al Hammond said, shows only 9 bedrooms.
Each bedroom,
Miss Wirt said,
contains 2 bunk-type beds, hence 18 accommodations in all. In addition, 5 of the beds are double, assisting those of you who wish to sleep with each other during your stay here.
I have a rule.
Runciter said irritably.
About my employees sleeping with one another.
For or against?
Zoe Wirt inquired.
Against.
Runciter crumpled up his map and dropped it to the metal heated floor.
I'm not accustomed to being told.
But you will not be staying here, Mr. Runciter,
Miss Wirt pointed out.
Aren't you returning to Earth as soon as your employees begin to function?
She smiled her professional smile at him. Runciter said to Joe Chip,
You getting any readings as to the Psi field?
First, Joe said, I have to obtain a reading on the counter field our inertials are generating.
You should have done that on the trip, Runciter said.
Are you attempting to take measurements?
Miss Wirt inquired alertly.
Mr. Howard expressly contraindicated that, as I explained.
We're taking a reading anyway,
Runciter said.
Mr. Howard!
This isn't Stanton Mick's business,
Runciter told her. To her drab assistant, Miss Wirt said,
Would you ask Mr. Mick to come down here, please?
The assistant scooted off in the direction of the syndrome of elevators.
Mr. Mick will tell you himself,
Miss Wirt said to Runciter.
Meanwhile, please do nothing. I ask you kindly to wait until he arrives.
I have a reading now, Joe said to Runciter, on our own field. It's very high.
Probably because of Pat, he decided.
Much higher than I would have expected, he said.
Why are they so anxious for us not to take readings?
He wondered.
It's not a time factor now. Our inertials are here and operating.
Are there closets? Tippy Jackson asked. Where we can put away our clothes? I'd like to unpack.
Each bedroom, Miss Wirt said, has a large closet, coin-operated. And to start you all off,
she produced a large plastic bag.
Here is a complimentary supply of coins.
She handed the rolls of dimes, nickels, and quarters to John Ild.
Would you distribute these equally? A gesture of goodwill by Mr. Mick.
Edie Dorn asked,
Is there a nurse or doctor in this settlement? Sometimes I develop psychosomatic skin rashes when I'm hard at work. The cortisone base ointment usually helps me, but in the hurry I forgot to bring some along.
The industrial research installations adjoining these living quarters,
Miss Wirt said,
keep several doctors on standby, and in addition there is a small medical ward with beds for the ill.
Coin-operated?
Sammy Mundo inquired.
All our medical care, Miss Wirt said, is free. But the burden of proof that he is genuinely ill rests on the shoulders of the alleged patient.
She added,
All medication dispensing machines, however, are coin-operated. I might say, in regard to this, that you will find in the game room of this suite a tranquilizer dispensing machine, and if you wish, we can probably have one of the stimulant dispensing machines moved in from the adjoining installations.
What about hallucinogens?
Francesca Spanish inquired.
When I'm at work, I function better if I can get an ergo-based psychedelic drug. It causes me to actually see who I'm up against, and I find that helps.
Miss Wirt said,
Our Mr. Mick disapproves of all the ergo-based hallucinogenic agents. He feels they're liver toxic. If you have brought any with you, you're free to use them. But we will not dispense any, although I understand we have them.
Since when?
Don Denny said to Francesca Spanish.
Did you begin to need psychedelic drugs in order to hallucinate? Your whole life's a waking hallucination.
Unfazed, Francesca said,
Two nights ago I received a particularly impressive visitation.
I'm not surprised,
Don Denny said.
A throng of precogs and telepaths descended from a ladder spun of finest natural hemp to the balcony outside my window. They dissolved the passageway through the wall and manifested themselves around my bed, waking me up with their chatter. They quoted poetry and languid prose from old-time books, which delighted me. They seemed so...
She groped for the word.
Sparkling. One of them, who called himself Bill.
Wait a minute,
Tito Aposto said.
I had a dream like that, too.
He turned to Joe.
Remember, I told you just before we left Earth.
His hands convulsed excitedly.
Didn't I?
I dreamed that, too, Tippy Jackson said. Bill and Matt, they said they were going to get me,
His face twisting with abrupt darkness, Runciter said to Joe,
"You should have told me."
"At the time," Joe said, "you..." He gave up. "You looked tired. You had other things on your mind." Francesca said sharply,
"It wasn't a dream. It was an authentic visitation. I can distinguish the difference."
"Sure you can, Francie,"
Don Denny said. He winked at Joe.
"I had a dream,"
John Ild said.
"But it was about hover cars. I was memorizing their license plate numbers. I memorized 65. And I still remember them. Want to hear them?"
"I'm sorry, Glenn," Joe Chip said to Runciter. "I thought only Apostos experienced it. I didn't know about the others. I..." The sound of elevator doors sliding aside made him pause. He and the others turned to look. Pot-bellied, squat and thick-legged, Stanton Mick perambulated toward them. He wore fuchsia petal pushers, pink yak fur slippers, a snakeskin sleeveless blouse, and a ribbon in his waist-length dyed white hair.
"His nose," Joe thought. "It looks like the rubber bulb of a New Delhi taxi horn. Soft and squeezable. And loud. The loudest nose," he thought, "that I've ever seen."
"Hello, all you top anti-size," Stanton Mick said, extending his arms in fulsome greeting. "The exterminators are here. By that, I mean yourselves."
His voice had a squeaky, penetrating castrato quality to it, an unpleasant noise that one might expect to hear, Joe Chip thought, from a hive of metal bees.
"The plague, in the form of various psionic riffraff, descended upon the harmless, friendly, peaceful world of Stanton Mick. What a day that was for us in Mickville, as we call our attractive and appetizing lunar settlement here. You have, of course, already started work, as I knew you would. Well, that's because you're tops in your field, as everyone realizes when Runciter Associates is mentioned. I'm already delighted at your activity, with one small exception that I perceive your tester there, dingling with his equipment. Tester, would you look my way while I'm speaking to you?"
Joe shut off his polygraphs and gauges, killed the power supply.
"Do I have your attention now?"
Stanton Mick asked him.
"Yes," Joe said.
"Leave your equipment on," Runciter ordered him. "You're not an employee of Mr. Mick. You're my employee."
"It doesn't matter," Joe said to him. "I've already gotten a reading on the psi field being generated in this vicinity."
He had done his job. Stanton Mick had been too slow in arriving.
"How great is their field?"
Runciter asked him. Joe said,
"There is no field."
"Our inertials are nullifying it? Our counterfield is greater."
"No," Joe said. "As I said, there is no psi field of any sort within range of my equipment. I pick up our own field, so as far as I can determine, my instruments are functioning. I consider that an accurate feedback. We're producing 2,000 BLR units, fluctuating upward to 2,100 every few minutes. Probably it'll gradually increase. By the time our inertials have been functioning together, say, 12 hours, it may reach as high as..."
"I don't understand," Runciter said.
All the inertials now were gathering around Joe Chip. Don Denny picked up one of the tapes which had been excreted by the polygraph, examined the unwavering line, then handed the tape to Tippy Jackson. One by one, the other inertials examined it silently, then looked toward Runciter. To Stanton Mick, Runciter said,
"Where did you get the idea that Psi had infiltrated your operations here on Luna? And why didn't you want us to run our normal tests? Did you know we would get this result?"
"Obviously he knew," Joe Chip said. He felt sure of it. Rapid, agitated activity crossed Runciter's face. He started to speak to Stanton Mick, then changed his mind and said to Joe in a low voice,
"Let's get back to Earth. Let's get our inertials right out of here now."
Aloud, to the others, he said,
"Collect your possessions. We're flying back to New York. I want all of you in the ship within the next 15 minutes. Any of you who aren't in will be left behind. Joe, get all that junk of yours together in one heap. I'll help you lug it to the ship if I have to. Anyhow, I want it out of here and you with it.
He turned in Mick's direction once again, his face puffy with anger. He started to speak. Squeaking in his metal insect voice, Stanton Mick floated to the ceiling of the room, his arms protruding distendedly and rigidly.
Mr. Runciter, don't let your thalamus override your cerebral cortex. This matter calls for discretion, not haste. Calm your people down and let's huddle together in an effort to mutually understand.
His rotund, colorful body bobbed about, twisting in a slow, transversal rotation, so that now his feet, rather than his head, extended in Runciter's direction.
I've heard of this, Runciter said to Joe. It's a self-destruct humanoid bomb. Help me get everybody out of here. They just now put it on auto. That's why it floated upward.
The bomb exploded. Smoke, billowing in ill-smelling masses which clung to the ruptured walls and floor, sank and obscured the prone, twitching figure at Joe Chip's feet. In Joe's ear, Don Denny was yelling,
They killed Runciter, Mr. Chip. That's Mr. Runciter!
In his excitement, he stammered.
Who else?
Joe said thickly, trying to breathe. The acrid smoke constricted his chest. His head rang from the concussion of the bomb, and feeling an oozing warmth on his neck, he found that a flying shard had lacerated him. Wendy Wright, indistinct, although close by, said,
I think everyone else is hurt but alive.
Bending down beside Runciter, Edie Dorn said,
Could we get an animator from Ray Hollis?
Her face looked crushed in and pale.
No,
Joe said. He too bent down.
You're wrong,
he said to Don Denny.
He's not dead.
But on the twisted floor, Runciter lay dying. In 2 minutes, 3 minutes, Don Denny would be correct.
Listen, everybody,
Joe said aloud.
Since Mr. Runciter is injured, I'm now in charge. Temporarily, anyhow, until we can get back to Terra.
Assuming,
Al Hammond said,
we get back at all.
With a folded handkerchief, he patted a deep cut over his right eye.
How many of you have hand weapons?
Joe asked. The inertials continued to mill without answering.
I know it's against society rules, Joe said. But I know some of you carry them. Forget the illegality. Forget everything you've ever learned pertaining to inertials on the job carrying guns.
After a pause, Tippy Jackson said,
Mine is with my things, in the other room.
Mine is here with me,
Tito Aposto said. He already held in his right hand an old-fashioned lead slug pistol.
If you have guns, Joe said, and they're in the other room where you left your things, go get them.
6 inertials started toward the door. To Al Hammond and Wendy Wright, who remained, Joe said,
We gotta get Runciter into cold pack.
There are cold pack facilities on the ship,
Al Hammond said.
Then we'll lug him there, Joe said. Hammond, take one end and I'll lift up the other. Apostos, you go ahead of us and shoot any of Hollis's employees who try to stop us.
John Ild, returning from the next room with the laser tube, said,
You think Hollis is in here with Mr. Mick?
With him? Joe said. Or by himself. We may never have been dealing with Mick. It may have been Hollis from the start.
Amazing, he thought,
that the explosion of the humanoid bomb didn't kill the rest of us.
He wondered about Zoe Wirt. Evidently, she had gotten out before the blast. He saw no sign of her.
I wonder what her reaction was, he thought, when she found out she wasn't working for Stanton Mick, that her employer, her real employer, had hired us, brought us here to assassinate us. They'll probably have to kill her, too, just to be on the safe side. She certainly won't be of any more use. In fact, she'll be a witness to what happened.
Now armed, the other inertials returned. They waited for Joe to tell them what to do. Considering their situation, the 11 inertials seemed reasonably self-possessed.
If we can get Runciter into cold pack soon enough,
Joe explained as he and Al Hammond carried their apparently dying employer toward the elevators.
He can still run the firm, the way his wife does.
He stabbed the elevator button with his elbow.
There's really very little chance,
he said,
that the elevator will come. They probably cut off all power at the same moment as the blast.
The elevator, however, did appear. With haste, he and Al Hammond carried Runciter aboard it.
Three of you have guns, Joe said. Come along with us. The rest of you...
The hell with that, Sammy Mundo said. We don't want to be stuck down here waiting for the elevator to come back. It may never come back.
He started forward, his face constricted with panic. Joe said harshly,
Runciter goes first.
He touched a button and the doors shut, enclosing him, Al Hammond, Tito Apostos, Wendy Wright, Don Denny, and Glenn Runciter.
It has to be done this way, he said to them as the elevator ascended. And anyhow, if Hollis's people are waiting, they'll get us first, except that they probably don't expect us to be armed.
There is that law, Don Denny put in.
See if he's dead yet, Joe said to Tito Apostos.
Bending, Apostos examined the inert body.
Still some shallow respiration, he said presently. So we still have a chance.
Yes, a chance,
Joe said. He remained numb, as he had been both physically and psychologically since the blast. He felt cold and torpid as his eardrums appeared to be damaged.
Once we're back in our own ship, he reflected, after we get Runciter into the cold pack, we can send out an assist call back to New York to everyone at the firm. In fact, to all the Prudence organizations. If we can't take off, they can come to get us.
But in reality, it wouldn't work that way. Because by the time someone from the Society got to Luna, everyone trapped subsurface, in the elevator shaft and aboard the ship, would be dead. So, there really was no chance. Tito Apostos said,
You could have let more of them into the elevator. We could have squeezed the rest of the women in.
He glared at Joe accusingly, his hands shaking with agitation.
We'll be more exposed to assassination than they will, Joe said. Hollis will expect any survivors of the blast to make use of the elevator, as we're doing. That's probably why they left the power on. They know we have to get back to our ship.
Wendy Wright said,
You already told us that, Joe.
I'm trying to rationalize what I'm doing, he said, leaving the rest of them down there.
What about that new girl's talent?
Wendy said.
That sullen, dark girl with the disdainful attitude. Pat something. You could have had her go back into the past, before Runciter's injury. She could have changed all this. Did you forget about her ability?
Yes,
Joe said tightly. He had, in the aimless, smoky confusion.
Let's go back down, Tito Apostos said. Like you say, Hollis's people will be waiting for us at ground level. Like you said, we're in more danger by...
We're at the surface,
Don Denny said.
The elevator stopped.
Wan and stiff, he licked his lips apprehensively as the doors automatically slid aside. They faced a moving sidewalk that led upward to a concourse, at the end of which, beyond air membrane doors, the base of their upright ship could be distinguished, exactly as they had left it, and no one stood between them and it.
Peculiar?
Joe Chip thought.
Were they sure the exploding humanoid bomb would get us all? Something in the way they planned it must have gone wrong. First in the blast itself, then in their leaving the power on, and now this empty corridor.
I think,
Don Denny said, as Al Hammond and Joe carried Runciter from the elevator and onto the moving sidewalk.
The fact that the bomb floated to the ceiling fouled them up. It seemed to be a fragmentation type, and most of the flak hit the walls above our heads. I think it never occurred to them that any of us might survive. That would be why they left the power on.
Well, thank God it floated up then,
Wendy Wright said.
Good Lord, it's chilly. The bomb must have put this place's heating system out of action.
She trembled visibly. The moving sidewalk carried them forward with shattering slowness. It seemed to Joe that five or more minutes passed before the sidewalk evicted them at the two-stage air membrane doors. The crawl forward, in some ways, seemed to him the worst part of everything which had happened, as if Hollis had arranged this purposely.
Wait!
A voice called from behind them. Footsteps sounded, and Tito Apostos turned, his gun raised, then lowered.
The rest of them!
Don Denny said to Joe, who could not turn around. He and Al Hammond had begun maneuvering Runciter's body through the intricate system of the air membrane doors.
They're all there. It's okay.
With his gun, he waved them toward him.
Come on!
The connecting plastic tunnel still linked their ship with the concourse. Joe heard the characteristic dull clunk under his feet and wondered,
are they letting us go? Or, he thought, are they waiting for us in the ship? It's as if, he thought, some malicious force is playing with us, letting us scamper and twitter like debrained mice. We amuse it. Our efforts entertain it. And when we get just so far, its fist will close around us and drop our squeezed remains, like Runciter's, onto the slow-moving floor. Denny, he said, you go into the ship first, see if they're waiting for us.
And if they are?
Denny said. Then you come back, Joe said bitingly, and tell us, and we give up. And then they kill the rest of us. Wendy Wright said,
ask Pat whatever her name is to use her ability.
Her voice was low but insistent.
Please, Joe.
Let's try to get into the ship,
Tito Aposto said.
I don't like that girl. I don't trust her talent.
You don't understand her or it, Joe said. He watched skinny, small Don Denny scamper up the tunnel, fiddle with the switching arrangement which controlled the entrance port of the ship, then disappear inside.
He'll never come back, he said, panting.
The weight of Glenn Runciter seemed to have grown. He could hardly hold on to him.
Let's set Runciter down here, he said to Al Hammond.
Together, the two of them lowered Runciter to the floor of the tunnel.
Oh, for an old man, he's heavy, Joe said, standing erect again.
To Wendy, he said,
I'll talk to Pat.
The others had caught up now. All of them crowded agitatedly into the connecting tunnel.
What a fiasco, he gasped, instead of what we hoped to be our big enterprise. Now you never know. Hollis really got us this time.
He motioned Pat up beside him. Her face was smudged, and her synthetic sleeveless blouse had been ripped. The elastic band, which fashionably compressed her breasts, could be seen. It had elegant embossed pale pink fleur-de-lis imprinted on it. And for no logical reason, the perception of this unrelated, meaningless sense datum registered in his mind.
Listen, he said to her,
putting his hand on her shoulder and looking into her eyes. She calmly returned his gaze.
Can you go back to a time before the bomb was detonated and restore Glenn Runciter?
It's too late now, Pat said.
Why?
That's it. Too much time has passed. I would have had to do it right away. Why didn't you?
Wendy Wright asked her with hostility. Swinging her gaze, Pat eyed her.
Did you think of it? If you did, you didn't say. Nobody said. You don't feel any responsibility then, Wendy said. For Runciter's death, when your talent could have obviated it.
Pat laughed. Returning from the ship, Don Denny said,
it's empty.
Okay,
Joe said, motioning to Al Hammond.
Let's get him into the ship and into cold pack.
He and Al once more picked up the dense, hard-to-manage body. They continued on into the ship. The inertials scrambled and shoved around him, eager for sanctuary. He experienced the pure physical emanation of their fear, the field surrounding them, and himself, too. The possibility that they might actually leave Luna alive made them more rather than less desperate. Their stunned resignation had now completely gone.
Where's the key?
John Ild shrilled in Joe's ear as he and Al Hammond stumbled groggily toward the cold pack chamber. He plucked at Joe's arm.
The key, Mr. Chip!
Al Hammond explained.
The ignition key for the ship. Runciter must have it on him. Get it before we drop him into the cold pack, because after that we won't be able to touch him.
Digging in Runciter's various pockets, Joe found a leather key case. He passed it to John Ild.
Now we can put him in the gold pack,
he said with savage anger.
Come on, Hammond. For Christ's sakes, help me get him into the pack.
But we didn't move swiftly enough, he said to himself. It's all over. We failed.
Well, he thought wearily,
so it goes.
The initial rockets came on with a roar. The ship shuddered as, at the control console, four of the inertials haltingly collaborated in the task of programming the computerized command receptors.
Why did they let us go?
Joe asked himself as he and Al Hammond stood Runciter's lifeless, or apparently lifeless, body upright in the floor-to-ceiling cold-pack chamber. Automatic clamps closed about Runciter's thighs and shoulders, supporting him, while the cold, glistening with its own simulated life, sparkled and shone, dazzling Joe Chip and Al Hammond.
"I don't understand it," he said.
"They fouled up," Hammond said. "They didn't have any backup plan behind the bomb, like the bomb plotters who tried to kill Hitler. When they saw the explosion go off in the bunker, all of them assumed..."
"Before the cold kills us," Joe said, "let's get out of this chamber."
He prodded Hammond ahead of him. Once outside, the two of them together twisted the locking wheel into place.
"God, what a feeling," he said. "To think that a force like that preserves life of a sort."
Francie Spanish, her long braid scorched, halted him as he started toward the fore section of the ship.
"Is there a communication circuit in the cold pack?" she asked. "Can we consult with Mr. Runciter now?"
"No consultation," Joe said, shaking his head. "No earphone, no microphone, no protophasons, no half-life. Not until we get back to Earth and transfer him to a moratorium."
"Then how can we tell if we froze him soon enough?"
Don Denny asked.
"We can't," Joe said.
"His brain may have deteriorated,"
Sammy Mundo said, grinning. He giggled.
"That's right," Joe said. "We may never hear the voice or the thoughts of Glenn Runciter again. We may have to run Runciter Associates without him. We may have to depend on what's left of Ella. We may have to move our offices to the beloved Brethren Moratorium at Zurich and operate out of there."
He seated himself in an aisle seat where he could watch the four inertials haggling over the correct way to direct the ship. Somnambulantly, engulfed by the dull, dreary ache of shock, he got out a bent cigarette and lit it. The cigarette, dry and stale, broke apart as he tried to hold it between his fingers.
"Strange,"
he thought.
"The bomb blast,"
Al Hammond said, noticing.
"The heat."
"Did it age us?"
Wendy asked, from behind Hammond. She stepped past him and seated herself beside Joe.
"I feel old. I am old. Your package of cigarettes is old. We're all old as of today because of what has happened. This was a day for us like no other."
With dramatic energy, the ship rose from the surface of Luna, carrying with it, absurdly, the plastic connective tunnel. 7.
Perk up pouting household surfaces with new Miracle Ubik, the easy-to-apply, extra-shiny, non-stick plastic coating. Entirely harmless if used as directed. Saves endless scrubbing. Glides you right out of the kitchen.
"Our best move," Joe Chip said, "seems to be this. We'll land at Zurich."
He picked up the microwave audiophone provided by Runciter's expensive, well-appointed ship and dialed the regional code for Switzerland.
"By putting him in the same moratorium as Ella, we can consult both of them simultaneously. They can be linked up electronically to function in unison."
"Protophasonically,"
Don Denny corrected. Joe said,
"Do any of you know the name of the manager of the beloved Brethren Moratorium?"
"Herbert something,"
Tippy Jackson said.
"A German name."
Wendy Wright, pondering, said,
"Herbert Schoenheit von Vogelsang. I remember it because Mr. Runciter once told me it means, Herbert, the beauty of the song of birds. I wish I'd been named that. I remember thinking that at the time."
"You could marry him,"
Tito Aposto said.
"I'm going to marry Joe Chip,"
Wendy said in a somber, introspective voice, with childlike gravity.
"Oh?"
Pat Conley said. Her light-saturated black eyes ignited.
"Are you really? Can you change that, too?"
Wendy said.
"With your talent?"
Pat said,
"I'm living with Joe. I'm his mistress. Under our arrangement, I pay his bills. I paid his front door this morning to let him out. Without me, he'd still be in his conapt."
and our trip to Luna,
Al Hammond said,
would not have taken place.
He eyed Pat, a complex expression on his face.
Perhaps not today, Tippy Jackson pointed out, but eventually. What difference does it make? Anyhow, I think that's fine for Joe to have a mistress who pays his front door.
She nudged Joe on the shoulder, her face beaming with what struck Joe as salacious approval, a sort of vicarious enjoying of his private, personal activities. In Mrs. Jackson, a voyeur dwelt beneath her extroverted surface.
Give me the ship's overall phone book, he said. I'll notify the moratorium to expect us.
He studied his wristwatch. 10 more minutes of flight.
Here's a phone book, Mr. Chip,
John Ild said, after a search. He handed him the heavy square box with its keyboard and microscanner. Joe typed out SWITZ, then ZUR, then BLVD, BRETH, MORA.
Like Hebrew,
Patch said from behind him.
Semantic condensations.
The microscanner whisked back and forth, selecting and discarding. At last, its mechanism popped up a punch card, which Joe fed into the phone's receptor slot. The phone said tinnily,
"This is a recording."
It expelled the punch card vigorously.
"The number which you have given me is obsolete. If you need assistance, place a red card in..."
"What's the date on that phone book?"
Joe asked Ild, who was returning it to its handy storage shelf. Ild examined the information stamped on the rear of the box.
1990, 2 years old.
That can't be,
Edie Dorn said.
This ship didn't exist 2 years ago. Everything on it and in it is new.
Tito Aposto said.
Maybe Runciter cut a few corners.
Not at all,
Edie said.
He lavished care, money, and engineering skill on Pratfall, too. Everybody who ever worked for him knows that. The ship is his pride and joy. Was his pride and joy?
Francie Spanish corrected.
I'm not ready to admit that,
Joe said. He fed a red card into the phone's receptor slot.
Give me the current number of the Beloved Brethren Moratorium in Zurich, Switzerland, he said.
To Francie Spanish, he said,
this ship is still his pride and joy because he still exists.
A card, punched into significance by the phone, leaped out. He transferred it to its receptor slot. This time, the phone's computerized workings responded without irritation. On the screen, a sallow, conniving face formed, that of the unctuous busybody who ran the Beloved Brethren Moratorium. Joe remembered him with dislike.
I am Herr Herbert Schoenheit von Vogelsang. Have you come to me in your grief, sir? May I take your name and address, were it to happen that we got cut off?
The moratorium owner poised himself.
Joe said, there's been an accident.
What we deem an accident, von Vogelsang said, is ever yet a display of God's handiwork. In a sense, all life could be called an accident. And yet, in fact...
I don't want to engage in a theological discussion, Joe said. Not at this time.
This is the time, out of all times, when the consolations of theology are most soothing. Is the deceased a relative?
Our employer, Joe said. Glenn Runciter of Runciter Associates, New York. You have his wife Ella there. We'll be landing in 8 or 9 minutes. Can you have one of your transport cold pack vans waiting?
He is in cold pack now?
No, Joe said. He's warming himself on the beach at Tampa, Florida.
I assume your amusing response indicates yes.
Have a van at the Zurich spaceport, Joe said, and rang off.
Look who we've got to deal through,
he reflected, from now on.
We'll get Ray Hollis,
he said to the inertials grouped around him.
Get him, instead of Mr. Vogelsang?
Sammy Mundo asked.
Get him in the manner of getting him dead, Joe said, for bringing this about.
Glenn Runciter,
he thought, frozen upright in a transparent plastic casket, ornamented with plastic rosebuds, wakened into half-life activity 1 hour a month, deteriorating, weakening. Growing dim.
Christ,
he thought savagely.
Of all the people in the world, a man that vital and vitalic.
Anyhow,
Wendy said,
he'll be closer to Ella.
In a way, Joe said. I hope we got him into the cold pack, too.
He broke off, not wanting to say it.
I don't like moratoriums, he said, or moratorium owners. I don't like Herbert Schoenheit von Vogelsang. Why does Runciter prefer Swiss moratoriums? What's the matter with the moratorium in New York?
It is a Swiss invention,
Edie Dorn said.
And according to impartial surveys, the average length of half-life of a given individual in a Swiss moratorium is 2 full hours greater than an individual in one of ours. The Swiss seem to have a special knack.
The UN ought to abolish half-life, Joe said, as interfering with the natural process of the cycle of birth and death.
Mockingly, Al Hammond said,
if God approved of half-life, each of us would be born in a casket filled with dry ice.
At the control console, Don Denny said,
we're now under the jurisdiction of the Zurich microwave transmitter. It'll do the rest.
He walked away from the console, looking glum.
Cheer up, Edie Dorn said to him. To be brutally harsh about it, consider how lucky all of us are. We might be dead now, either by the bomb or by being lasered down after the blast. It'll make you feel better once we land. We'll be so much safer on Earth.
Joe said, the fact that we had to go to Luna should have tipped us off.
Should have tipped Runciter off, he realized.
Because of that loophole in the law dealing with civil authority on Luna, Runciter always said, be suspicious of any job order requiring us to leave Earth. If he were alive, he'd be saying it now. Especially don't bite if it's Luna where they want us. Too many prudence organizations have bitten on that.
If he does revive at the moratorium, he thought, that'll be the first thing he says. I always was suspicious of Luna, he'll say. But not quite suspicious enough. The job was too much of a plum. He couldn't resist it. And so, with that bait, they got him, as he always knew they would.
The ship's retrojets, triggered off by the Zurich microwave transmitter, rumbled on. The ship shuddered.
Joe, Tito Aposto said, you're going to have to tell Ella about Runciter. You realize that?
I've been thinking about it, Joe said, since we took off and started back.
The ship, slowing radically, prepared by means of its various homeostatic servo assist systems to land.
And in addition, Joe said, I have to notify the society as to what's happened. They'll rake us over the coals. They'll point out right away that we walked into it like sheep.
Sammy Mundo said,
but the society's our friend.
Nobody,
Al Hammond said,
after a fiasco like this, is our friend.
A solar battery-powered chopper, marked Beloved Brethren Moratorium, waited at the edge of the Zurich field. Beside it stood a beetle-like individual wearing a continental outfit, tweed toga, loafers, crimson sash, and a purple airplane propeller beanie. The proprietor of the moratorium minced toward Joe Chip, his gloved hand extended, as Joe stepped from the ship's ramp onto the flat ground of Earth.
"Not exactly a trip replete with joy, I would judge by your appearance,"
von Vogelsang said as they briefly shook hands.
May my workmen go aboard your attractive ship and begin—
Yes, Joe said. Go aboard and get him.
Hands in his pockets, he meandered toward the field's coffee shop, feeling bleakly glum. All standard operating procedure from now on, he realized.
We got back to Earth. Hollis didn't get us. We're lucky. The lunar operation, the whole awful, ugly rat-trap experience is over, and a new phase begins, one which we have no direct power over.
5 cents, please,
the door of the coffee shop said, remaining shut before him. He waited until a couple passed by him on their way out. Neatly, he squeezed by the door, made it to a vacant stool, and seated himself. Hunched over, his hands locked together before him on the counter, he read the menu.
Coffee, he said.
Cream or sugar?
The speaker of the shop's ruling monad turret asked.
Both.
The little window opened, a cup of coffee, two tiny paper-wrapped sacks of sugar, and a test tube-like container of cream slid forward and came to rest before him on the counter.
One international pause cred, please, the speaker said.
Joe said, charge this to the account of Glenn Runciter of Runciter Associates, New York.
Insert the proper credit card, the speaker said.
They haven't let me carry around a credit card in 5 years, Joe said. I'm still paying off what I charged back in...
One pause cred, please,
the speaker said. It began to tick ominously.
Or in 10 seconds, I will notify the police.
He passed the pause cred over. The ticking stopped.
We can do without your kind, the speaker said.
One of these days, Joe said wrathfully, people like me will rise up and overthrow you, and the end of tyranny by the homeostatic machine will have arrived. The day of human values and compassion and simple warmth will return. And when that happens, someone like myself, who has gone through an ordeal and who genuinely needs hot coffee to pick him up and keep him functioning when he has to function, will get the hot coffee whether he happens to have a pause cred readily available or not. He lifted the miniature pitcher of cream, then set it down.
And furthermore, your cream or milk or whatever it is sour.
The speaker remained silent.
Aren't you going to do anything?
Joe said.
You had plenty to say when you wanted a pause cred.
The pay door of the coffee shop opened, and Al Hammond came in. He walked over to Joe and seated himself beside him.
The moratorium has Runciter in their chopper. They're ready to take off. They want to know if you intend to ride with them.
Joe said,
look at this cream.
He held up the pitcher. In it, the fluid plastered the sides in dense clots.
This is what you get for a pause cred in one of the most modern, technologically advanced cities on Earth. I'm not leaving here until this place makes an adjustment, either returning my pause cred or giving me a replacement pitcher of fresh cream so I can drink my coffee.
Putting his hand on Joe's shoulder, Al Hammond studied him.
What's the matter, Joe?
First my cigarette, Joe said. Then the 2-year-old obsolete phone book in the ship, and now they're serving me week-old sour cream. I don't get it, Al.
Drink the coffee black, Al said, and get over to the chopper so they can take Runciter to the moratorium. The rest of us will wait in the ship until you come back, and then we'll head for the nearest society office and make a full report to them.
Joe picked up the coffee cup and found the coffee cold, inert, and ancient. A scummy mold covered the surface. He set the cup back down in revulsion.
What's going on?
He thought.
What's happening to me?
His revulsion became, all at once, a weird, nebulous panic.
Come on, Joe,
Al said, his hand closing firmly around Joe's shoulder.
Forget the coffee. It isn't important. What matters is getting Runciter to...
You know who gave me that pause cred?
Joe said.
Pat Conley. And right away, I did what I always do with money. I frittered it away on nothing, on last year's cup of coffee.
He got down from the stool, urged off it by Al Hammond's hand.
How about coming with me to the moratorium? I need backup help, especially when I go to confer with Ella. What should we do? Blame it on Runciter? Say it was his decision for us all to go to Luna? That's the truth. Or maybe we should tell her something else. Tell her his ship crashed, or he died of natural causes.
But Runciter will eventually be linked up to her, Al said. And he'll tell her the truth. So, you have to tell her the truth.
They left the coffee shop and made their way to the chopper belonging to the beloved Brethren Moratorium.
Maybe I'll let Runciter tell her,
Joe said as they boarded.
Why not? It was his decision for us to go to Luna. Let him tell her himself. And he's used to talking to her.
Ready, gentlemen?
Von Vogelsung inquired, seated at the controls of the chopper.
Shall we wind up?